committee who replaces our new member also, who's since been redeployed, I don't know to which committee, Mr. Naren Singh, who represents the IFP, who is, according to the letter that I have here, he's been nominated as the principal member in this portfolio committee. Welcome, Mr. Singh.
Thank you very much.
No, it applies to all parties. I think all parties actually are guilty of this. Because I see the ANC is doing exactly the same, the IFP has done the same, the DA has done exactly the same. I think it's better for the National Assembly to address. Let's go to the House.
The IFP really let us down because the previous member was not only clever, very clever, she was also very gorgeous.
What
I tell you, we're saying something
about Mr. Singh's looks.
Chair, I see the IFP are still the old whooping horse here.
Okay, let's get out.
I'm not giving up, Chair, on the mandate I have from the previous member.
Oh, okay. No, it's fine. Let's get out to business. We already have lost 15 minutes. Minister, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair, members. Firstly, an apology for the DG. If you turned on the screen, you would see he's in E249 with Scopa this morning, because there's the discussion of the annual financials with Scopa. He's starting there, but hopefully he will join us in the course of the morning. And then an apology for the delayed start. It's one of those days when the printer you need for the presentation will not deliver what you want it to. Let me just indicate that the presentation is quite far-reaching because it deals with a number of institutions. The institutions each play their role in a particular geographical space, but the mandate in respect of both development on the continent and also more broadly the international policy issues, you're going to find the threads in there. And so part of what we want to talk about is the extent to which each of these institutions has a very particular place and space, and we live out our engagements through these institutions. The first of these is the oldest institution. Clearly the oldest customs union in the world. It was a gift from a departing colonial power. Around the time of the formation of union in 1910, and SACU has been through a few incarnations. The most recent was the SACU treaty, which though negotiated in 2001, was signed into law and ratified by Parliament in 2003. In terms of what you have in SACU at the moment, there is now an institutional form. There is a secretariat based in Windhoek. Previously it was sort of just done on the basis of an annual meeting or so by ministers. Now there is an institutional form. Part of that institutional form is a council made up of the ministers of finance and the ministers of trade together. The ministers of trade, partly because the customs union is grandfathered in terms of the Uruguay round of the GATT, which precedes WTO, and so as a customs union it has that kind of status. The consequence of which is that when South Africa enters into trade negotiations, it no longer does so narrowly as a sovereign, it does so as the Southern African Customs Union. So the role of the trade ministers is exceedingly important. And part of that role is one that will see a developing institution that will, for all of the Southern African Customs Union, have negotiate the common external tariff. Yeah, the trend up until now, and you know, for the past 97 years, chairperson has been one where South Africa looked at this issue, determined what the tariff would be, and this tariff then became applicable across all of SACU. Now, and the treaty makes provision for this, you will have an institution that develops capable of taking account of the issues, and the institution would be representative of all five SACU member states. The change in formula has seen very significant increases over the past few years. Do we have the total numbers? Of SACU transfers? Okay. The total. And a little technology issue. The total transfers the Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, Swaziland total transfers in the 07-08 fiscal year would be 23 billion rand. And in 2004-05, that number was 13 billion rand, and if you go back to 2000, it was 8 billion rand. So there has been a very significant change as a consequence of the application of the formula, and that presents us with quite a difficulty. The second issue that I think we need to be mindful of is that the dependence, especially by Swaziland and Lesotho for revenues from the customs union, has grown in leaps and bounds. It now accounts for over 50% of the budget of Lesotho and over 63% of the budget of Swaziland is accounted for directly. Now, one of the things that we've done is we've used the window period to ask that the formula be reviewed so that we can deal with these issues differently going forward. There are huge challenges in the context of stuff. These issues we've covered. But in the context of the formula, the elements of it, which is based on the key variable in the formula, is the dependence of a country on intra-SACU trade. So that if indeed you were Swaziland and you are very dependent on your large neighbor in South Africa for a lot of the imports and exports, you have a very high ratio and therefore your share increases. Whereas the South African economy, which tends to be a more highly internationalized and trades outwardly more, would then be entitled to significantly smaller share. These are issues that we will have to negotiate, and I'm saying that we've given notice that we will do precisely that and ask for a revised basis. The second institution is SADC. Now, of course, there is an overlap. All of the SADC members are also SADC members. If you look at the Angola, is a member of SADC. It means that they're boxing them. If you look at that, then the other issue that you can see is that there's also an overlap into the common market for East and Southern Africa. And then in the case of Tanzania, it shares with Kenya and Uganda, the East African community. Now, I'll come back to the other slide, but this one is important, and I don't know if they've distributed this, but there's this wonderful graphic representation that we've used in the committee on previous occasions. It looks like this.
We haven't circulated it because we were waiting for the rest of the presentation. We thought we would circulate the...
It's on its way.
Okay.
Okay. It's a rather complex set of ellipses that deal with, it's called the African Galaxy, and tries to map out the overlapping membership. And as we've explained before, each of these institutions has its origin in some or other historic event. The customs union goes back to 1910. It was South Africa and the protectorate, as it was then described, that needed an arrangement between themselves. In 1981, SADC was started, and that was SADC Net of South Africa, and it had two C's. And it was started by the frontline states with the express purpose of trying to limit the dependence, the economic dependence of the frontline states on South Africa. In the treaty change in 1992, the one C was dropped, and it became a community. Away from a coordinating conference, it became a community. And that was actually quite important. And in August 1994, very soon after our first democratic election, South Africa then joined SADC. Now, the early focus was on economic development. It looked at issues like infrastructure, people-to-people contact, and a series of those kinds of issues. There have been a number of changes in the past while, including an increased focus on trade. And so one of the issues that we are implementing at the moment is the SADC Trade Protocol. The Trade Protocol is one of the key targets in, it's got such a long name, it's one of those places where an acronym actually works, the RISDP, the Regional Integrative Strategic Development Plan. In terms of that, there are certain targets to be met for various parts. Obviously, obviously there needs to be measurable change towards the idea of a common market. But the first of those would be a free trade area which should be realized by 2008. The next stage, as per this document, the Regional Indicative Strategic Development Plan, is a customs union which the plan says should be realized in 2010. Now, in respect to the free trade area, the protocol is there, it's quite a detailed protocol. Theoretically, you can move towards it. But there are certain challenges, as we learned in the detail when we gathered in Lusaka a few weeks ago, just ahead of the CELIC summit, heads of state summit. There was a detailed meeting that looked at these issues, and amongst the elements that you require for a free trade area is that you need a common tariff. Now, one of the difficulties, Chair, is that some countries are actually quite dependent on customs revenue because they don't have inland revenue. They don't have a sufficiently developed tax system. And so whilst there may be commitments in respect of the broad thrust, some parliaments still haven't ratified the protocol, but in broad terms, you know, you can ask any head of state, any minister, they will tell you that they support the free trade area. They believe that we can meet the objectives by next year. But firstly, you need to be able to effect great alignment of the tariffs. Secondly, in cases where countries are very dependent on customs revenues, they need to find an alternate revenue source. And thirdly, this previous slide we looked at on the overlapping membership is actually a difficulty. The textbooks will tell you that you can't, and in fact the rules of the WTO would prevent any country from belonging to two customs unions. And the textbooks will confirm that. But even when you're looking at that very necessary step of a free trade area, you begin to understand that if you go back to the Galaxy slides, the page we handed out, if you go back to that page, then you will see that if a country like Egypt, which is a member of COMESA, and in terms of the common market endeavors of COMESA, you get a country like Swaziland, which is also a member of COMESA. The trade arrangements that Swaziland would benefit in terms of SADC should also be extended to COMESA. And therefore, it extends to Egypt in as much as it extends to neighboring South Africa. Now this does create a bit of tension and something we have to work through. The ministers of finance and trade had placed this before heads of state, as I say, in Lusaka a fortnight ago. But the key issues in the context of SADC remain that endeavor to focus on regional economic integration, to take that broad theme, try and break it down into its component parts, and then look at what we can do together. Now there are some things that are working and working well. I mean, there is a road that starts in Maputo. You can get on that road and drive right across the Walvis Bay. So it comes through Mozambique, South Africa, Botswana, into Namibia. In respect of infrastructure, there are very important developments. There is the energy powerful, which is a very significant development, and if there were money on the table for the Inga scheme on the Congo River, then energy, not just self-sufficiency, but energy surplus generation, allowing this part of the world to export electricity to other, clean electricity to other parts of the world, would be greatly enhanced. So those kinds of developments are in place, but they need to be matched with a series of other things. And some of the challenges towards regional integration, I think, continue to test the mind somewhat. Chair, included in those would be issues such as free movement of people, free movement of capital, etc., etc. I mean, you can go to Europe, get a Schengen visa, and travel in between countries on intercontinental Europe. We don't yet have those kinds of schemes for ourselves in the region. And so you've got to look across the board at all elements that will make for better regional integration. An exciting but very challenging area of work. The three important Pan-African institutions, firstly the African Development Bank. It was established alongside the OAU in 1964. It was headquartered in Abidjan in the Ivory Coast. It has moved temporarily to Tunis. Its power and responsibility across the continent is growing, and we'll come back to that in a moment. The second is the Economic Commission for Africa, established by the United Nations, headquartered in Addis Ababa. Very significant change in the last few years. What this slide does not indicate is a very important area of work in respect of statistics. Chair, the UN staff had taken a decision that by 2010 was, I think, a year on either side of it, all of the world must undertake census. Now, there are some countries on the continent that haven't had a census for the last 40 years or so. Some of them because of war and so on. So the best numbers are the wildest kind of estimates imaginable. Something that we'll turn to in a moment, because it's important in the policy discourse, is the Millennium Development Goals. Now, if you don't know how many people there are, and you have no idea actually of the rate of economic growth, and your assumptions on inflation are quite untested, you don't know what the current account and the balance of payments is doing, you don't have a statistical base, then you can't actually report progress in terms of the MDG. The Economic Commission for Africa has taken this up, and StatData is playing a very important role. And I mean, amongst the big positives are countries like Angola and the Sudan, where they are now laying the basis to ensure that the statistical wherewithal is in place, allowing those countries as well to look at preparing for census. I think that these are very, very important and significant changes, allowing us to measure progress or the lack thereof on the continent. The heads of state at the summit in Banjul last year gave the AU a very strong mandate on regional economic communities. Some of the agency of the establishment of the RECs would be with the African Development Bank. The oversight function is with the African Union. So the work we're doing in the context of SADC also feeds in to the AU, the ADB, because, and let me digress, part of the debate of the AU summit in Accra this year was between those who argued immediately for the United States of Africa and those who argued that we should have a slightly longer route with a focus on regional economic communities, which will deal with issues of trade, issues of macroeconomic convergence, etc., so that you can get this, but by a slightly longer route. That was where the debate was. And so the discussions that took place in Lusaka at the heads of state meeting are actually important because they have to speak to that reality. And the reality is the mandate to build strong, functioning regional economic communities, as we have to do in the context of this part of the world in Southern Africa. The African Development Bank is undergoing renewal, and the focus is largely on the infrastructure development of the on the continent. So you will find two broad thematic areas. So one is very strong overlap with NEPAD, and the second issue, Chair, is the need for the ADB to look beyond the southern borders. I referred earlier to the road that runs from Maputo to Walvis Bay. The biggest challenge on the African continent is to deal with the reality of too many countries. I think there are 16 landlocked countries on the continent. And therefore the costs of economic activity are increased greatly. Yeah? Unless you have the infrastructure in place, you can't use even the fertile land. You can't get inputs in, irrigation, fertilizer, all of those things, and you can't get products to market. So the infrastructure issues are fundamentally important. The second area significant investment would be in the social infrastructure, schools, clinics, and all of those kinds of facilities. The ADB is an important lender in these areas as well. Then, in policy areas, the ADB is taking off, and one of those policy areas is to support countries in that transition from a dependence on customs revenue to the development of inland systems or internal systems of taxation. The point raised is that we've increased our shares as a shareholder in this bank. We play a far more active role, the country support program paper that the CSP asked us to play an active role in regional integration. Do you mind? I'm trying to teach Mr. Cole to count. No, maybe we must do that later.
Depends. If he's a fast learner, you can try.
Turning then to the World Bank. You know, the World Bank is now in its 63rd year. for the past 63 years, it has had, as the president of the World Bank, a citizen of the United States of America. Structurally, it has the president who comes in and brings along with him, it's always been him, a management cadre. And then there's the institutional management, you know, people who are there as professionals and have been there for a very long time. They have their own minds. And then there is an executive board now comprising of 24 men and women representing constituencies. Some of these are single country constituencies, the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, Germany, France, Italy. Other G7 countries like Canada are not single country constituencies. And then there are the multiple country constituencies like ours, which has 21 African countries. And Francophone Africa, which has 24 African countries. Now, it doesn't take rocket science to understand that if you are the United States and you don't borrow from the bank, but you have a large team and a single country constituency, your leverage is significantly different from that of Mali, which is a borrower from the bank because it can't go to capital markets, and but is one of 25 countries in a constituency, serviced by one executive director. So the reform issues in the bank are actually incredibly strong. We've argued over a long period that there must be an open process for the appointment of the president of the bank. Also, there needs to be a representation of Africans, especially at all levels of the bank. And that there needs to be significant reform of the constituencies. The bank's role tends to be stronger in respect of low-income countries. Middle-income countries like ourselves, in fact, find it cheaper to borrow from capital markets than what we borrow from the bank. Curiously, the largest two borrowers from the countries that are borrowing most extensively from the bank at present are China and India. I mean, the Chinese story is certainly a very interesting one because China, as we know, has about $1.3 trillion of reserves. The bulk of that, probably around the trillion mark, would be invested in the United States treasury bonds and bills, keeping the U.S. government in the style that no government ought to become accustomed to. But they borrow. They borrow partly because of technical assistance, partly because of the nature of the challenges, including a range of environmental issues and so on. And India lags in respect of infrastructure. There have been some very significant investments in infrastructure, including a metro system, I think, that has 63 stations in the Greater Delhi area, and then this quadrangular road that, for the first time, constructs a kind of diamond-shaped freeway system across all of India. It's pretty difficult because you know, you've got Buffalo and trucks and rickshaws and buses and all kinds of things in the roads, but there is a freeway system now. Also, in India, one of the big challenges is the provision of water and sanitation to more and more people. So their infrastructure borrowing from the bank is quite extensive. Each year, the bank produces a report which is available on the website, which is called the Global Monitoring Report. And this Global Monitoring Report deals with the kind of state of the world's development. It would give you the best bird's eye view of performance against the Millennium Development Goal. It would also draw on other trends, including trends in respect of ODA. Now, if I think back to the last report on ODA, amongst the trends was the line for official development assistance tends to be increasing. If you remove certain elements from that and included in those elements would be very significant debt relief to two countries, Iraq and Nigeria. And you remove the kinds of funds that are donated at times of severe stress, like a tsunami or something like that, then the broad trend in ODA is actually in decline. It's a worrying factor. The source for that would be the development center of the OECD, but it's factored into the same report, and these I'm saying the information is published and readily available. Go to the World Bank website and you would find a copy of the report. One of the things that the bank does with its member countries is to reach agreement on a country strategy paper. In the context of South Africa, we are now in the process of finalizing our paper, and it deals with a few issues. One of them is tries to drill down and look at the issues of poverty in the context of South Africa. What are the things we might do to deal with that? The second deals with the reality of urbanization. It has happened in this country, as in other countries, with quite an alarming speed. I mean, people leave poverty in the rural areas, find their way into the city. The cities are not actually prepared to receive people, and you have this phenomenon of very rapid informal settlements. How do you deal with those kinds of issues? Not going to disappear. You know, UN Habitat has made announcements about getting rid of informal settlements and so on. But urbanization is one of the biggest challenges that confronts a country like South Africa. That's the second strand. And the third issue, Chair, deals with the matters of public transport. At face value, we have a very good system of roads, and even commuter rail and so on. But none of that explains why it takes you 3 hours to travel between Pretoria and Johannesburg. So, exploring these kinds of issues, and because, you know, you're not starting anew. You're dealing with a very large conurbation in Gauteng. How do you change this, is an important part of the work we're doing on this country strategy paper, and I'm sure once the paper is finalized, we will be able to share it with this committee. Sorry. When I said 16, Neil said he's got a map of Africa on his computer, and he says, no, there are only 10, and he's counting 10. Momo now has found the 15 number. I say, let's live with 16, and Africa, we are responsible for the decisions taken in Berlin in 1880. Turning to the IMF. The IMF has been very much in the news for two reasons. The first is the appointment of the managing director. And you know, there have been a few of these kinds of events. I mean, since I've been Minister of Finance, there was Vishal Kamdasu, former governor of the Bank of France, who was the managing director. He handed over to Horst Köhler, who currently is president of the Federal Republic of Germany. And he, when he became president, handed over to the former finance minister in Spain, Rodrigo Durazo, who now has asked that his contract be terminated sometime later this year. This creates a vacancy. We've been quite resolute about the fact that you must have an open process. The European finance ministers met in Strasbourg and came up with the name of Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was once finance minister in France, and hoped that everybody would just say yes, because Europeans have a birthright to the managing director of the IMF. And we have argued that you must have an open process. And our arguments have not been sufficiently strong, but just last week the Russian executive director in the IMF said that he doesn't. The Russian view is that Dominic Strauss-Kahn is not capable, and they are advancing the name of the former governor of the central bank in the Czech Republic, Joseph Tosovsky. And so now there is a debate. You know, we've been trying to speak to colleagues elsewhere in the world and ask whether there's any other name to challenge that of Dominic Strauss-Kahn. He happens to be a very competent individual, but we were exploring. I mean, you need to have an open process for this. There's a second vacancy, and this would be for a governor, and governors are finance ministers, and this would be to chair the International Monetary and Finance Committee, which meets twice a year. And the job was held by the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, now Prime Minister of the UK, Gordon Brown. And he held that job for 10 years, and so there's a vacancy there, and there's quite intense lobbying about who should chair at IMFC. As Africans, we have to raise the fact repeatedly that there are too few Africans in the upper echelons of the institution. Last year, the managing director of the IMF put together a task team to look at the fact that the IMF was facing some financial difficulties. Yes, even the IMF chairperson faces these things from time to time, and they put together a committee chaired by Andrew Crockett, who before then was the boss of the Bank for International Settlements. And amongst the people included in that task team was, in fact, our very own governor, Tito Mboweni. Now, the difficulty that the IMF faces is that since its inception, its articles allowed for it to lend to countries facing balance of payments difficulties. It charges a margin, it sits with reserves of gold and cash. It charges a margin on those, on the lending, and then it's capable of employing all of these people and running not a shabby organization. Now no countries of substance have any program with the fund. You know, there were many countries that borrowed as a result of the Asian crisis and so on. So Indonesia had a big program, Thailand, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Russia had a big program. But what they did was, as they were able to afford it, they kind of said, all right, you know, where's my wallet? We'll pay you out now, and that settles it now. If you're not lending to anybody, then you don't have an income stream. If you don't have an income stream, then the institution will die. So the profits report, which again is a public report, deals with the issue of revenue for the IMF going forward. And amongst the issues, and this is why I say Governor Mboweni had an important role to play, the one enormous asset that the IMF has is gold. It's valued at $35 an ounce in the books. And just the revaluation will give you a different picture, but, you know, if you just, if the Honorable Gibson's chair just took all of the silver rand and so on that he has, and he revalues it, it doesn't necessarily provide him with income. He may be wealthy, but it doesn't provide him with income. And the IMF has the same problem. Even if you revalued both of them. So there would have to be some sales of gold and so on, but we want to manage the environment. You know, apart from some ultra-leftists and so on, I think that we recognize that the IMF has a very important role to play, and one of the important roles it has to play is the surveillance, as done under Article 4. Our Article 4 report was concluded. What we've decided as a government for the third year running, we released the entire report so that people, all South Africans, or anybody interested in the country must know what the IMF says. Their view, not our view. Largely they support the policy decisions, but then, you know, from their own perspective, they would raise a few issues, labor market issues, and so on, that they think requires attention. And then, surprisingly, they support us in areas where some South Africans may be somewhat hesitant, including, I mean, the IMF says to us, please, get on and sort out this land reform. You need to do more than what you're doing. And the other area where they complimented us, and they clearly watching us very closely, is in the area of black economic empowerment. There are also a series of other issues covered in the Article 4 report, including detailed analysis of sectors, and one of the sectors that the IMF Article 4 report covers is the FSA, Financial Sector Assessment Program. I can't remember this thing. I'm too old now, Jerry. But, you know, they commend us very strongly, and, you know, amongst the reasons why they do that is because we have a strong legislative and supervisory framework. And the Banks Amendment Bill, which had served before this committee and was passed by the National Assembly last week, would further enhance the position of the country. Basel II would enhance that. So all of those issues are considered by the Article 14, and that surveillance role gives you the best comparison. The battle now is to get all countries to agree to the publication of the Article 4 report in the details. One of the issues that the IMF needs to be quite concerned about in the present is the extent of volatility in financial markets. It started, Chair, as we know, with the subprime loans in the United States housing market. It included all manner of irrationality, including what are now called ninja loans. They've been lending to people, no income, no job, no assets. And these people have been able to buy houses. But if you're doing that kind of thing, without any evaluation of how the mortgages will be serviced, then you're going to have a problem. It would appear that that is a rational thing to do, but that rationality was absent from the way in which these decisions were taken. And what the banks then did was that they packaged these subprime loans as collateralized debt obligations, sold it on to the hedge funds, and you've just had this amazing domino effect that has taken root in a very short space of time. Now it happens to coincide with another set of issues, which is called carry trade investment. And what investors have been doing is they go to countries where interest rates are low. They take a view on the exchange rate and interest rate, borrow money. You go to Japan, you borrow money where interest rates are, it's 0.5%. You take a view that says that the exchange rate of the yen will be stable over a long period. You borrow money there and you go and invest it in more risky markets. But then suddenly, the yen appreciates. Now you've got a problem because your investments are very soon going to be underwater. So you've had these two things coinciding. And you know, a lot of this has been masked in these hedge funds. I mean, a company like Bear Stearns in July announced that the two hedge funds in its stable were in serious trouble. Very soon thereafter, Goldman Sachs had to find $3.6 billion for one of its hedge funds. And there's been this knock-on effect, which has then seen this financial crisis. On August the 9th, the European Central Bank pumped in about 95 billion euros. That's 950 billion rand approximately into the market. Now, if you want to understand the scale of this, then you need to pause and consider the fact that the day after 09/11, on the 12th of September 2001, they pumped into the market 69 billion euro because of the shock. The subprime lending had created so much of a shock that they had to pump in 95 billion. In fact, the ECB in August, since that day, has pumped more than 200 billion euro into the market. And this has been very rapid. And I think that it just attests to the fact that in the financial market there is a cynic's view of history that says the only thing that history teaches us is that history teaches us nothing. Mm. People have been making so much money for a number of years that the last bear market is out of their mind. So, you know, it's been a big problem, and this has created difficulties across the world. If you look at the JSE, by the 9th of August, the JSE was 267% up since March 2003. And then, on Friday the 10th of August, the top 40 index lost about 167 billion rand of value. So these are very rapid changes. I mean, what have we been doing? You know, the Article 4 report just says we've been minding our business and doing not too badly at it. They say we commend the South African government for macroeconomic management. But notwithstanding that, the speed of the contagion and the extent arising from this financial crisis is actually very, very rapid. Now, sure, there's been a fallback, but you know, overnight in trade in Asia, there is again a fresh spate of volatility. The question, Chair, is how do you resolve these problems? How do you help people from themselves? There's an article in an influential global newspaper today. I can't mention it, but they tell me the color of the pages is salmon. I don't know. I don't eat that kind of fish, but they say the color of the pages is salmon, and there's an article that argues against central banks being involved in lending to fools. Yes, the heading says central banks should not rescue fools from their folly. But of course, there's an enormously difficult problem. If you don't do it, then what starts out as a financial crisis gains momentum, and you know, you get deep economic impact in the consequence. Then I think central banks would not be true. However, if they stand in where people have misbehaved and behaved irrationally, create money and pump this into the market every time, then there's an enormous moral hazard, because those who are misbehaving don't actually have to see through the consequences of their irrationality. So there's a difficulty. And I'm saying that one of the difficulties that the IMF has to deal with is clearly in the context of that fourth bullet point. Now, we need to bear in mind as well that this is happening in an environment of huge global imbalance. Countries, especially oil-producing countries, are sitting with huge surpluses on the current accounts of balance of payments. And oil importing countries are sitting with deficits. There are also countries that are neither, that are sitting with huge surpluses, like China. Incidentally, in this market volatility we've seen over the past few weeks, the Chinese stock market has been quite untouched, I'm scared. I'm mentioning that because I think understanding some of those phenomena are also important in understanding what our international engagements are, what alliances we construct with whom, about what issues, what impact that may have on even these institutions which were created at Bretton Woods in 1944, at the tail end of World War II. It's a different world. It's a far more globalized world, and so the posture that we take on these kinds of issues is very important. The next set of issues is something we have very direct responsibility for this year, and that is the G20. We chair the G20 this year, and the G20 comprises finance ministers and central bank governors from the countries listed in the first bullet point. And broadly, this would be the G7, but the other countries who are considered to be systemically significant for the financial system in the world. No, there's a typo that Mr. Cole is very worried about. We chair this G20 for the year, And the way in which this is managed, there isn't an institution that employs many people. We chair this year, we provide the secretariat this year. We took over from Australia, who hosted the ministerial in Melbourne in November, and next year the chair will rotate to Brazil. So there's a troika responsible. We manage the themes. We ensure that we can deal with some issues on the agenda, and other issues remain so that there's a continuity of issues as well. For instance, the Bretton Woods reform issues, one of our three themes for this year has come along from Australia. The fiscal space issue will be taken up by Brazil next year as part of their themes. In November we will host this a conference, and I think it will be the first time that we have such a galaxy. I mean, just exclude South Africa for now, but such a galaxy. You'll have the G7 finance ministers, central bank governors, and in fact, from all of these countries, the heads of the IMF, the World Bank, the European Union will all participate, and the WTO will all participate in this meeting. So it's got to be quite a significant meeting to attract people like that. The three themes have been dealt with in the course of the year by seminars taken to other countries. So the seminar on Bretton Woods reform was held in Rio de Janeiro. I've discovered that the DG in the Treasury can't plan, and so they missed Shrove Tuesday, they missed the carnival by 1 week now, you know. It just explains how difficult things can be with people who don't plan. We had a seminar on commodities and the macroeconomic impact of commodity price changes, which was hosted by the United States. And we had a seminar on, we call it fiscal space, but the proper name, research is the fiscal elements of growth. Fiscal elements of growth and development. That seminar was hosted in Turkey. Next week in Durban, the DG will host what is called the deputies meeting. It will be the build-up to the ministerial meeting to be held in November. And they will work through a series of these issues. The overarching theme, as the slide says, is partnership and sharing. Not sharing. One of the questions that arises in the discourse, Chair, and let me, I know that we'll have a lot of discussion about these issues. There's one view that emerged in Canada, actually, that this G20, because it comprises very significant countries, should be taken up to a leadership level. That instead of a G7 or G8, you should in fact have this G20 at leadership level, meeting in summit once a year, because the shape of the world has changed. Just this week, President Sarkozy had made a different proposal that it should be about 13 countries or so. But this debate will not go away. And right at the center of that debate is the recognition of the extent to which the world has changed. And the industrialized nations of the 60s are no longer the only countries that are significant in respect of the global economy. Let me conclude, Chair, by just drawing attention to some of the challenges that we continue to work on. The first of those is the Millennium Development Goals. In the file that was distributed just now, you will find a reference to the MDGs. Each of the goals is set out, and when the heads of state meet at the United Nations General Assembly on about the 24th of September, they will look at progress, because between 2000 and 2015, this is the midpoint of the MDGs, and it's necessary that we are able to report on this, and key is the fact that Africa lags so far. The biggest challenge, and something that we shared with this committee previously, Chair, is that even the halving in Africa still leaves the continent far behind the rest of the world, and you know that is the scale of the challenge. The second set of issues relate to the economic integration. I said that it's part of our country's strategy paper with the ADB. It's central to the work of the African Union. It's part of that, what the foreign ministers called the grand debate of Accra this year. It's part of the SADC mandate, and we have to live this through. And, you know, even dealing with some country-specific issues from time to time, the finance ministers in a region like SADC are called upon to look at the issues and examine this. The last point here is to play the role of the world's conscience. G8 summit at Glen Eagles was very strong in its commitment to the doubling of aid to Africa. Some of the spirit of that was confirmed in Heiligendamm in Germany in June of this year. But we're nowhere near that. And so part of our international responsibility is to ensure that the agencies are producing the numbers, that the numbers are there, that the world can actually see how far it has digressed from the commitments it made voluntarily. The first time the commitment was made to 0.7% of GNP as official development assistance was in 1972. We were very young then. But I think that there are now five, perhaps six countries in the world that have met that obligation. So the commitments are made, but there is continual ignoring of those commitments, and so the responsibility to ensure that these commitments are met is for us, in the work we do internationally, an important element, and I say the conscience of the world about commitments. Chair, it's a complex set of issues. I'm saying that there's a continuity between what we do. If you look at the SACU issues and you can't find a consonance of themes and energy with what we do in the World Bank or the G20, then there's something wrong. There has to be a consistency across all of what we do, and what we've tried to do is it's a kind of Tour de France. It's a complex, hilly thing that we've tried to get through this morning. But we offer that to the committee for discussion. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Minister. That was quite a lot. And this is the first of this kind of engagement. And I trust that the committee has actually benefited from this huge volumes of information. I now open it for a discussion in the committee.
Can I propose that perhaps we take each slide so that we can effectively engage the minister, because there are a lot of talks in the slide.
Okay. Can I then recommend that we break for 10 minutes and then come back and do it?
Chair, can I just tell you I was in a discussion once about this landlocked stuff. Now, you know, in the middle of Senegal is a country called the Gambia. And it's just a little sliver like that. And the story is that the commander of the British garrison had a cannon on each side of the river, turned it around, so it fired into the forest. It did the same on both sides of the river, and where the cannonball fell, they marked the boundary, which is what created that sliver. Now, the coastline is about, you know, just so much. The debate is whether that is landlocked or not, but we can think about that in detail.
Okay, let's break for 10 minutes. Can we be back here by 10 past? Mr. Beatley. Okay, the proposal by Mr. Nguni earlier was that we go through it slide by slide. Seeing that there are not too many hands at the moment, maybe, and Mr. Nguni during the tea break has also withdrawn the proposal. Are you amending it or withdrawing?
It has been withdrawn, but amended in the proposal that chair, you asked the questions again.
I don't know what that means, but the normal process is that we ask as many questions as we can, but we have 3 questions at a time so that we are able to. Then we can take more than one batches. Mr. Afia.
Chair, thank you, Chair.
With great respect, it may not be an entirely bad idea to find a midpoint between the slide by slide and the nature of the question, so that even if the questions aren't asked in this way, I would ask for permission to be able to deal with the thematic issues. So, you know, when the questions come up, I'd like to be able to take all of the SACU, all of the SADC, World Bank, IMF, etc., with your permission. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks. I would have thought that was automatic. When you respond. Okay. Oh, manual is manual. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know, Chair. I've got 2 questions, one in SADC and one in World Bank. All of them, that's okay. Thanks, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairperson. I want to say that this interaction from the word go was a good one. I think that we have to have it systematically so that we cannot have sometimes. We as a committee should not find one thing on these issues. The question, Chairperson, is around SADC, the issue of the debate which the minister raised in terms of the issue of African Union, where the heads of state, some of them were saying now, the others are saying it has to be systematically moved in. But there was no time frame. And in the same vein, Chairperson, when you look at SADC issue, that we do have this thing of SACU and the issue of once more of the development or the movement of people from one country to one country. How do we deal with that? So that it can also deal with this wrong perception. This thing of the illegal migrants and so on, which Bradaki maybe you can think of him is going to ask that kind of a question of Zimbabwe, I'm not asking it for you. The one of the World Bank, the issue of poverty measuring in the African context as well as the issue of the global context. I want to understand when is this going to be done, because it's a long debate. How long is it going to take so that we can be able to find a middle way? When we as in the African context, how do we understand what does it mean by poverty to us as well as a global the developed countries. When are we going to come up and close this chapter and meet each other halfway so that maybe we can look at this issue of poverty? Because why is so busy sitting in the boardroom discussing how do we measure poverty? People are dying, are poor there with hunger. But we're sitting and discussing and we don't end this debate of how do we measure poverty. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Gibson. Thank you, Chairperson. Since you're limiting the number of questions, I won't ask Minister Manuel the question about the IMF in view of the possibility of people other than those with a birthright succeeding to the throne, whether Africa's candidate might be the Honourable Mr. Manuel. I'd like to move to questions that I am going to ask. And that is to talk about the G8. The President of France made an interesting suggestion, and I think you just very briefly referred to it. He suggested that the G8 should be increased by the inclusion of China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Mexico. In other words, really become a G13. Now, this was discussed in newspapers yesterday, and they said that you declined the comment and referred the comment to the presidency. The presidency declined the comments and referred it to Foreign Affairs, who were unavailable for comment. It all sounds uncharacteristically modest. Perhaps you'd comment on that and on President Sarkozy's motivation in wanting to convert what's now sort of an ad hoc invitation to these countries and to us into something more formal. That's the first thing. Then the second one I'd like to ask you is about the progress being made with the economic partnership agreement with Cotonou coming to an end on the 31st of December. Now, together with two members of Parliament from the ANC here, I represent South Africa on the Joint Parliamentary Assembly of the African, Caribbean, Pacific, and European Union. And of course, there's great angst among many, many countries about the lack of progress which is being made. They just don't seem to be getting there. And it's sort of a doomsday scenario for trade for a lot of underdeveloped and developing countries in the world. South Africa is in a much stronger position because we have our own agreement, irrespective of what happens. But what effect do you think this would have on our neighbours, who are very important to us, if the EPA for SADC is not negotiated by them? Or do you think in the final event they'll crack and accept the advice that Dennis Kinnock and others give to Europe to enter into some interim arrangement while proper negotiations continue?
Mr. Mgoli.
Thank you. On SADC, during the investment protocol, we informed that few countries have signed the protocol. Many of them have signed the protocol due to difficulties in negotiations. I've since asked the question, but I never got a satisfactory answer, that are the differences ideological or technical, as South Africa seems to be throwing its weight around in SADC, or the view I have that South Africa is trying to wait around the SADC due to a lot of issues that I can quote. Second question, Chair. You just said that within SADC, countries like Lesotho, Swaziland, they earn about 63% or 63% of their GDP from SACU. Now, when you go to integration, financial integration in SADC, and also trade in the Sahara state. As the
ministerial committee, have you looked into the issue of how those countries are going to survive if we form a free trade agreement that that income will actually diminish? Third question, Chair. You just said that during this market volatility, China has remained unscathed. And there is a growing view that China is actually trying to form another, should I say, market as compared to the Western London Stock Exchange. And also the visit of the Chinese Prime Minister in Africa is seen as a move towards that should I say, strategy to create alternative markets to the US, the European market. What is South African economic position on that issue? Thank you.
Mr. Biri.
Thanks, Chair. Slide 6 of the presentation, Chair, the members are referred to this overlapping membership. Very good explanation. But firstly, the issue of SACU and SADC, seeing that members of SACU are also members of SADC, one would like to pose a question as to what would be then the significance of keeping these two bodies. Why is it not a duplication of work? Is it possible then to merge the two and make one single organization? Second point here would be the possibilities of meeting the free trade free trade area by 2008 and Customs Union by 2010. Is it practical? Is it, or is there any strategy or any thinking done to reduce that? The last one, Chair, will be on the issue of World Bank. Firstly, one would be very interested in finding the mechanism of transformation in this institution. But further, mention was made in the media that Mr. Silva Manuel himself was in the running to replace the then fired president of this institution. Were you ever in running for that post? Thank you.
The last one in this bench is Mr. Mlondro, and then we will pass it to the next one.
Thank you, Chief. I just want the Minister to elaborate more on the issue of financial integration, with particular reference to the possibility, and let me use also practical example, the possibility of other African countries, SADC countries, and the private sector in SADC, raising capital from our well-developed capital markets. For instance, a company in Botswana or Mozambique wanting to list with the stock exchange with the view of raising capital. And even governments from SADC raising capital through our bond markets. Now, my concern is, I just want to find out whether they are, the issue of macroeconomic policy convergence has been given sufficient attention. Because if I'm Sanlam or any institutional investor and I want to invest in the bond market, I mean Zimbabwe, Botswana, whatever, they want to raise money through bonds, you know, there are other issues that I would be concerned about, you know, in relation to macroeconomic policy stability. And the same with the private sector. I would want to know about the corporate governance issues, the auditing profession, how is it being regulated. I mean, are we moving towards the harmonization of all the things that I mentioned? My second question, Chair, would be on, I think, the first slide, which the Minister didn't elaborate on. It was on SABU, sorry, yes, it was on SABU. There's a point where you say development intentions of fiscal transfer not apply. Can you elaborate more on this point? My last question, Chair, is the last one, which is, there is a communique from the head of state, which was on, I think, the 16th Tuesday. And let me read point 14. I just saw it now. It's from the batch that you delivered to us. Tag 8. In this communique, point 14 of it, say that the summit took note of the report of the Executive Secretary of the Economic Situation in Zimbabwe and mandated the SADC ministers responsible for finance to use the report of the Executive Secretary in consultation with the government of Zimbabwe and draw up an economic plan to support Zimbabwe. Can you elaborate more on this and what did the Executive Secretary, the report of the Executive Secretary instruct the Minister of Finance to look at which are the areas that we are instructed to look at?
Okay, can we allow for responses to these questions before we move on to the next debate? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. In respect of Mr. Moloto's question on SACU, it's the only pure SACU question, and it's that the fiscal transfer issue. In the formula, there is a developmental component. So, narrowly defined, the one part of it of the transfers would include, in fact, there are three components. The one part of it is the customs pool. What you collect in customs is then shared in the context of this ratio that I spoke about. And the key variable there is the intra-SACU trade. Right? That's the one part. The second part of it is the excise pool. Now, whether excise should or shouldn't be part of the customs pool is something you must debate. I mean, you know, because all of the sin taxes are, of course, in that excise pool, and if South Africans have greater thirst than couldn't have it then. Let's just hypothesize and say South Africans consume more alcohol per capita than Basutu. Then, you know, we should at least be entitled to that part of our excise. It shouldn't necessarily be divided. So that's the second part of the debate. And the third is there's a developmental component. Now, our submission is that the developmental component should exist or should be based on a calculation which is in inverse proportionality to per capita GDP. In SACU, the country that has the highest per capita GDP is Botswana. And the country with the lowest per capita GDP, because it's a least developed country, is Lesotho. The division of the money ought to be such that per capita Lesotho gets more than Botswana. In fact, you have a relationship in direct proportionality to the per capita GDP, and our submission is that that's not correct. It should be amended. If you don't amend it, then where is the developmental measure in the application of the pool? So that's the explanation on that. Now, Chair, there are a series of questions about SADC. I'd actually like to start in the middle. There is, as we speak actually, there's a separate debate in the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry that deals with regional economic integration. And Deputy Minister Rob Davies is doing a presentation there. And I hope he says the same things that I'm saying. There are major contradictions. Because this will be the subject of member statements this afternoon, if indeed there is. In terms of regional economic integration, there are a variety of schools of thought which define methodologies. I mean, you could take the European example. And you know, the European community is celebrating its 50th anniversary now. But the progress was very slow, and then there were step changes along the way. And key amongst those step changes would be, I mean, if you look at the Maastricht Treaty and the criteria set down towards monetary union, it was a big political decision, and then a pushing towards macroeconomic convergence, which then laid the basis for the European Central Bank. But before that, this idea of this common market and so on and so on, you know, it was a fairly slow process. Now, key in terms of our decisions is the speed with which we can travel. SACU or SADC in this indicative strategic development plan sets out a number of criteria and deadlines. So I jump to Mr. Moloto's question. And the macroeconomic convergence criteria. Inflation rate single digit by 2008. 5% by 2012 and 3% by 2018. Ratio of budget deficit to GDP not exceeding 5% by 2008 and 3% is an anchor within a band of 1% by 2012. And the nominal value of public and publicly guaranteed debt should be less than 60% of GDP by 2008. Those are the clear macroeconomic convergence criteria. Clearly, in a country like South Africa, we have no problem in meeting those criteria. If you look at this slide, you see, we have in SACU, you can look at this from different perspectives. The one part of it is, South Africa, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland, this is the first level of integration. They have a common monetary area. Well, they have nominal currencies, but those currencies are all pegged to the rand, and we pay seigniorage for the use of the rand because it's entirely convertible. The second level is then the customs union level. Botswana's added and the Pula isn't pegged to the rand. But you will find across those five countries that the macroeconomic convergence ratios are actually incredibly high. Now, that notwithstanding the fact that if you looked at Botswana relative to the other four, their interest rates are actually higher. But because they are as dependent as they are on trade with South Africa, our inflation would have to be their inflation. But their interest rates are higher. But because of that development, you've got a very high level of convergence. If you want a SADC-wide customs union by 2010, then the speed of convergence is very important. one route that you can take is make an announcement, there shall be a customs union by 2010. But I don't know how you get there if you have countries that have quadruple digit inflation or immeasurable fiscal deficits or things like that. It just becomes incredibly difficult. You could take an approach called variable geometry and you can measure this and say, all right, out of the list of SADC countries, if you've taken the BLM and countries in South Africa, what's the position in Zambia? Might they be converging towards us? What about Mozambique? And then allow those countries to be part of a customs union that develops along a different trend. One of the issues, Mr. Mwili, that you have to consider is that the customs pool is not a gift from South Africa. It has to be based on revenues actually collected at the customs gate. It might be collected at Durban, but the goods may be destined for Lesotho or Swaziland. And that's the premise. Because it's not a gift, if you add in all of those countries to just the five countries, the chances are that each of the countries will end up with a bit less money. And that's likely to happen because of the preponderance of the scale of the South African economy relative to the rest of the South. So we, as a country, are not going to be affected to the same extent, but, you know, if you are saying that Swaziland is as dependent on these customs revenues for their budget, and they end up with less, then their ability to provide public services are going to be reduced. So you get CANs in the equation, beyond the politics. And I think this is what requires a very careful management in the interrelationship between SADC and SADC. I mean, I can say it here, you know. Last year, the DG, I think he came to this committee and spoke about the rate of change in the pool. And one of the newspapers reported what he said, and within days, I was peppered with letters from the BLNS countries. How could the DG say these things? But I don't think the DG told an untruth because those figures are measured. So in the budget review, it's a published number, and this arose immediately, I think after the MTBPS last year or something like that. It's a published number, so, you know, part of it is political. Part of it arises because countries might not want citizens to know that it comes from the pool, because then there might be a notion that they are too dependent on South Africa and those kinds of things. So it requires, you know, this multilateral politics is a complex thing. You can't always say what you need to with the speed with which you say it. So, you know, But it's something that very much is on our radar screen. The question is, can we reach a SADC-wide customs union by 2010? My submission, and there might be others who disagree with me, but my submission would be that we won't get there by 2010. But this doesn't mean that you abandon the idea. How you get there needs to have a plan, and you must be prepared to make the announcements up front and deal with these issues as you progress, children. The investment protocol question asked by Mr. Nguni, 10 countries have signed and are in the process of ratifying. Various stages, sometimes, you know, ministers sign, parliamentary processes take a long time. The four countries that haven't signed are Angola, Namibia, Malawi, and Zambia. Sometimes it's just complexities of change of government and so on and so on. You know?
Did they?
It's a process issue, certainly. On the issues of the economic partnership agreements with the European Union, the problem that Mr. Gibson's correct, South Africa is a separate entity. We couldn't benefit from Cotonou or its predecessor name just escapes me. But the key issue is that it would be preferable if the EU negotiates with SADC. It's complex enough taking the SACU countries and negotiating or trying to negotiate a trade agreement with the United States, with India and with China. But what the EU seems to have done is that they've carved out what they call East Africa and left the remainder. Now, the argument is that if in the approach of the African Union, this region is the essence, in essence, the regional economic community, however you define it, take the targets for convergence and so on, set out in the RIFDP, then we must ask of Brussels to negotiate with an entity to strengthen that entity. Because the divisions into East and West don't help in that arrangement. And that's a battle that must be won. It's actually something that the trade ministers are taking up. I'm saying our position is a discrete position, but we have to be part of that voice to ensure that Brussels deals with the region as a region, because that would be preferable. If you have that, then it's also easier to facilitate the convergence in the region, because if you don't do that, it's quite impossible to get the markets to work or to get cross-border flows. Everything would attract the premium, and I turn to the question about borrowing and capital markets. Interestingly, between the JSE and the Namibian Stock Exchange, they use the same platform, and of course it's the same platform as London, so that Namibian companies could be traded, are traded, on the JSE. With capital markets, the same kind of approach works. And what has helped is two things. The first is that some institutions like the World Bank and the IMF have actually raised capital in our market. So the World Bank and the African Development Bank have raised capital in the RAND market and allocated it so that the exchange rate differential is between that country and the RAND, and it helps with that kind of integration. We've encouraged it, and I think others can follow suit. Sometimes governments would prefer to hang on, because everybody wants their own stock exchange and so on, wants to develop their own bond markets, when in fact it makes more sense to take an approach which supports larger, more efficient markets. One of the converse trends is that the DBSA, whose annual report will be launched tomorrow, has actually been able to lend, because, you know, about a third of their book is in the rest of SADC, outside of South Africa. They've been able to lend in both Zambian and Malawian currency, taking out the exchange rate risk for borrowers there. It's working, and I think you need to put all of those things in place and track it through, and I think we will see in the fullness of time what happens. Your question on Zimbabwe is work in progress. I would have hoped that... You see, you've had a rotation of the chair now from Lesotho to Zambia. I would have hoped that our colleague Magande would have convened us by now. He hasn't done so. The report on an economic package, I think, is wide open. There will be a fair amount of debate about the Executive Secretary's report and what it sees as the nature of the crisis. The Zimbabweans have to accept that as well. Now, I needn't tell Mr. Molodzo that it's hard to get a single view on this matter. But it's something we have to work at. And, you know, I don't believe that this requires anything different of us than something that was discussed in the House last week. At the end of it, we can present to Zimbabweans what the options are. What the SADC finance ministers can't do is to take the decisions for Zimbabwe. Fundamentally, prices have to work in your economy. You know, last week we had a grocery meeting in Maputo, and I was saying to Dumisa Jelly there, I remember going to Maputo first, where there was a board at the central bank that had the official rate of the black market rate for Medicare. But it's not like that anymore. Zimbabwe, I mean, Mozambique took the hard decisions, and now you know, perhaps the economy is still quite dollarized. But the economy functions. The changes are measurable, and they have a measurable effect in the quality of life of people. You can encourage, but the decisions have to be taken by a government and supported by a parliament. And that's the point that we need to get to. Whether you're talking of the general politics or the economic recovery program in Zimbabwe, I mean, it's getting past the other issues and getting to the tough decisions that inevitably have to be taken. Mr. Ashir had asked about this regional economic community, and I'm saying what the RISDP gives you are a series of dates to right up to 2020, in fact. Part of managing this is ensuring that you can work through the issues here so that you have higher levels of convergence. I know that questions put to Governor Mboweni when he came to the committee relate also to the idea of a currency. Now, for as long as countries have diverged in macroeconomic terms as some countries are, it's a non-starter. But if you took the SACO countries and had a trading area, you don't have to call it a rand, you can call it something else. It's going to be fairly easy because your macro economies are as converged as they are. Which is why, you know, hard as it is, you can get a region like this going. If you go to the rest of the continent, you look at West Africa, there's ECOWAS. Within that, There's also the TFA franc zone, and you've got a single central bank that manages all of the former French colonies, the francophone countries that have as their currency the CFA franc. And as you deal with those kinds of issues, you enhance convertibility, you enhance therefore macroeconomic convergence. So you then have two regions. The Maghreb, I think, will find its own way, but let's just focus on sub-Saharan Africa. East African community, I'm saying, has three countries, Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda. But there's a part that I think everybody sort of walks away from. It's, so you'll find it in that soup. It's called IGAD. IGAD is in the Horn of Africa, and it's countries like Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, and the Sudan. Nobody wants to rush there. So, you know, I'm saying it's a complex set of issues. Djibouti would have to be in there as well. But, you know, unless you've got an anchor like the East African community advancing, I think you're going to have a problem with those issues. On the question that, questions on the World Bank, Chair. What is it? You know, one of the things that the World Bank does is to advance on the policy debates, and every year, you know, it's not a bad document for members of Parliament, especially of this committee, to have on their shelves, is the World Bank's development report. In 2004, the theme was making services work for the poor. 2005, better investment climate. 2006, equity and development. 2007, development and the next generation. And 2008, they will look at agriculture and development. So there's a series of good material, because they're very smart people who work in the institution, and the people involved in these world development reports are actually they don't fit into the mold that some people have, this idea of the World Bank being crusty right-wingers who can't think. I would offer members these reports, I think, just in testimony of the fact that you can actually advance the wider policy discourse, and these documents are an important part of it. The World Bank can't define for us what poverty is. Sitting in the World Bank are people who research poverty. Our own poverty measure is a process that is now reaching fruition. It's a joint initiative between the Treasury and StatsSA. And it's a matter that we must come to Parliament on. Perhaps within the next 6 weeks or so. But it's our stuff. We can draw experience, and there are ways of measurement, and there's a literature of how to measure poverty, but it has to be ours. It's not going to be an easy thing, because members of Parliament always describe themselves to the Mosoneke Commission as poor. I agree with it as a member of Parliament. But it's not the same as the very poor in society, kind of. So, you know, also, there is a fear that some of these measures may be used for industrial relations. So, a measure of poverty, if you're a trade unionist, might be 5,000 rand per person per month. But if you're an employer, it might take on a very different view, and so it's going to be a difficult issue. But I think we should have something on the table within the next 6 weeks or so. I don't think that Mr. Mwili and Mr. Gibson were actually asking me those questions. There was a question about China and alternative markets. I'm coming there. On China, firstly, there is a fear that the West has about China. It's a funny kind of thing because we don't want China exploring the resources because we were the colonial masters, we should have first choice. No, just take that view. Go back and look at what has been written about this issue. And that is the fear. Now, I think there are two points to make about this. The first is that the Premier of China can say without fear of contradiction, we have never colonized one square inch of Africa at any time. But we've been engaged. You know, dealing with landlocked countries, there's a railway line that runs from about there to there. We call it the Tanzan Railway. It was built by the Chinese in the 60s and dealt with the landlocked nature of the Zambian economy and that copper belt in particular. It's somewhat in disrepair now, but it can be redeveloped, it should be redeveloped, and those kinds of things have been there, and people tend to forget. But what do you have from the continent? Primarily raw materials and an enormous appetite. You can go to any country, take Zambia. And Zambia's fortunes have been tied into the copper price. And the copper price was in very serious decline. The World Bank said to Zambia, you've got to sell your copper mines. You sold them to Anglo-Americans who couldn't hang on to them. But China, because they're electrifying at such a rate, you know, they're turning on one coal-fired power station a week now. To be mining copper is not a bad thing. So the copper price has lifted, the Zambian kwacha has lifted, the Zambian economy has lifted. Of course they're alternate markets. I don't know if they're permanent. I think there must be some time when China says, hold on. You know, we can't have two electricity connections per household. You know, we've gone too far now. There must be some time like that. But for now, I think the tide is flowing favorably. And then, you know, in some areas like Luanda, which is very run down in Angola, but it's a wealthy country. There are all kinds of Chinese construction companies involved there. And 5 years from now, I would hazard that Angola is going to look quite different because the investment that goes into Luanda right now when the oil prices are strong. There is, of course, debate around an Asian Monetary Fund as an alternative to the IMF. I don't want to make a judgment on that, except to say that there's got to be some reason why the Chinese are the largest borrowers from the World Bank. And the Chinese tend to take a very long view of the world and world development. And I would just invite members to watch that, try and understand it. On the issue of the Sarkozy proposal, the reason why it wasn't me. I blame Correa for it. No, we really haven't considered it. There have been other proposals. One of them is the one I referred to, which was a Canadian proposal, which says take the G20 beyond finance ministers and take it to the leadership level. Now these are difficult arrangements. Everybody talks about the G8 summit. But when finance ministers meet, they meet as a G7. Russia's not included. So people try and carve out interests, you know. There might be some times that they like South Africa there. Other times perhaps we don't matter in the same way. Mexico has become a very fashionable place, but not so long ago Mexico was excluded from the equation. You're never quite going to reach a satisfactory arrangement. I mean, the one difficulty, even with the G20, is there's only one African country. And that's us. So there'll always be grievances. I mean, some of the things that we're doing next week, when the deputies meet in Durban, there will be a seminar. I think it may even be on a slide somewhere. On the G20 slide. You see, we want to take the same G20 because you're going to have deputies there from the G20. But all of the African countries have been invited to debate the fiscal elements of growth. There was a previous summit previous African-wide seminar that dealt with that other question of aid effectiveness. So we want to bring Africa, not as a, we can't claim to be the representative for the continent. But you know, you've got to work at these things and work at them and try and create as inclusive a platform. But let me assure you, honorable members, that it's a heck of a lot easier to work with 20 countries than to work with 184. So, you know, those are the ongoing debates, but I pause here.
The list now has Mr. Bigsby, Mr. Marais, Ms. Fabs, and Mr. Fink.
I don't think it's really that much. There's something wrong. We still have that account, but I don't think it's really a big part which can give us a total.
Thank you, Chef. First of all, I wanted to congratulate congratulate the minister for the informative presentation he has given us. More so to me as a person who has not been involved in foreign activities. But may I go on, Honorable Minister, to say, if you could imbue in your cabinet quarter the other ministers to do likewise, it would be wonderful. Chair, my first question would be on slide 9, page 4, the last bulletin. Honourable Minister, would you perhaps expand a little bit as to what they mean by the middle class countries and what challenges these middle class countries are imposing? The second question would be, Honorable Minister, in the second slide about SACO, mention is made of challenges. In your own observation, Minister, are there any strategies to overcome these challenges? Or would they best deteriorate into progress? Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the Minister as well for the presentation. The first issue for me is about this African Union, and especially if one look at the African galaxy, and it must be incredibly confusing from someone from outside to try to make something from that picture. I just want your view on the possibility of a rationalization of trade and custom unions in the whole of Africa. Is that principle? And then also, in terms of these challenges in Africa, what in your view can be the constructive and developmental roles that South Africa can play to address these African challenges? And then, a question in terms of which interests me is the South African Article 4 report and what can possibly come from that. And I'm saying to myself, you know, you have given us a picture or a glimpse of this global village where we live in. And I know there's a lot more to this village than what we've heard this morning. Now, if one go back to the South African circumstances, I mean, we've got local issues. We've got labor. We've got many other issues that is important for us and for our communities. I do believe that one must approach a South African holistic approach on dealing with those South African issues. But then you've got SADC. And then you've got this global market where South African SADC is a relatively small economy. Now, things that happens in South Africa might have a little or no impact in the world economy, but issues and developments in the world economy might have a huge and devastating impact or positive impact on the South African economy. Now, if you could maybe help us as South Africans and as lawmakers and as consumers, what lessons should one take from this? And how should one approach the South African challenges from this global perspective as South Africans? Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Hobbs.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Certainly one echoes the comments of other members of the committee that this has been indeed a very welcome presentation. Thank you. Mine is with respect to the take-up of the leadership chairing the G20. And one of the aspects there, the reform of the Bretton Woods institution, which is indicated here, has been on the table now for at least 7 years or so. And that South Africa, under South African's chairpersonship, this will continue. We will continue to put emphasis in this direction. Now, I think what is critical here in looking at the material that we have been given is this, I think, challenge that we've been facing for some time on how to address the governance issues and the democratization of the IMF in this regard with respect to membership, which then also has a bearing on the access to funds. Which is noted here, is this going to be a function of the actual existing quota system? What is the purpose? What current purpose is the quota system serving, if not, in fact, to provide some kind of glass ceiling to some of the, if you like, more emergent economies coming into this grouping? And how should we deal with it? I think there is, one of the objectives indicated here is that you are going to pursue further alignment of the quotas with the relative economic positions of IMF member countries. But that's precisely the question around which we would invite further clarification and comment with yourself, comment from yourself, Minister. Does this current quota system not serve as a negative form of discrimination for the influence and access to finance of other members who don't share the same quota.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the warm welcome. I must apologize to colleagues that sorry I cannot make up for the beauty of my former colleague who sat here, but I'll certainly try to make up in other ways to contribute to this committee. And I think my inclusion in this committee has been quite timely because we have the benefit of the Honorable Minister giving us this wonderful presentation. I just have three small questions. One is on SACU. And the Minister did speak about the formula and a review of the formula. I'd just like to know what's the broad thinking of government or the Minister on how the formula should be reviewed. And on SACU, the administration thereof and the distribution of funding, who is responsible? Is there a little administrative unit called within SACU that deals with the distribution of the resources? And then on the African Development Bank, the Minister also indicated that South Africa is a shareholder. I'd just like to know to what extent, what percentage of shareholding, and if who are the other shareholders within the African Development Bank. And lastly, on the World Bank, the Minister also indicated to us that if we look at the website, we'll be able to get more information. But what I'd like to know is, does the World Bank lend to governments only, or do they lend to institutions within a country? And if so, what role would a government like the South African government play if the World Bank has to advance resources to any organization within the country? Thank you.
No, this is completely. They are saying we should rest assured that we will certainly await those meaningful contributions from you. You know, whichever way those come. So let me also join the chorus here in congratulating the men. Job well done. Sir, I think the Minister has put our country on a pedestal, never known. South-South relations, multilateral, African role, budget surplus, we can name a few. I guess the other question that remains is how best do we maximize on occasions like this, without being in, with what word, having been informed to understand one has in mind here a question. We are now chair of the G20 as parliament. I think we did raise this question initially in our earlier engagement. How best can we leverage on such opportunities as Parliament. Without, I guess here we are confronted with a situation where most of these occasions, especially when they take place in South Africa, in Cape Town where we are, we should be able to find ways. These are very empowering exercises that I would imagine we really need to get ourselves, so that we don't find ourselves caving on information that is otherwise there in the past, and that is good to take place, but never get to be able to get ourselves informed of those. It's just one comment here. The specific two questions, one, the overlap of membership and the incompatibility in policies in the member states. A point is made here, it constrains the regional integration. For me, I can only imagine some of those incompatible policies relating to exchange rate, independence of the central bank, inflation targets. If it is possible that we could be more elaborate on these incompatible policies that become a constraint on regional integration. So that's the first one. The last one, Chair, relates to the IMF Article 4. It's an old question. One of the comments made there is that, of course, it also commends our country about its budget surplus. Question for me there is, as a country, here we have this budget surplus. On the one hand, our level of exposure, debt-wise, is reducing because we are able to make use of that surplus to reduce our risk or exposure. Is that a policy that National Treasury only arrives at, or is that more of an executive decision or a policy that is arrived at as to what then happens to this budget surplus, that money that you did not budget for, you did not budget for it. You then have to make use of that money. What policies do you arrive at in beginning to say, here the issue is we have unemployment, we have poverty, we have all these issues and ills of society that we really need to catch up on. And the choices that we have made with that surplus that we happen to achieve. Thank you.
I would want us to take responses, but I'm being punished here for having limited members when they ask questions at the beginning. And I see Mr. Mngoni's hand was up. Are there any other hands for the next batch? If there are, then I'll take responses before I go to those. Or would you just want them to ask this question? Let's do that. Okay.
Let me just again try and deal with these type of questions. The first question asked by Mr. Beatley is about the challenges. And I think that what we're looking for is a measure of increased integration. And if all you have is pot of money that doesn't facilitate integration, that doesn't facilitate industrialization, then we're going to be weaker going forward. I think the point to understand that we need to understand is that even the issues that we were dealing with 10 years ago have been overtaken by time and circumstance. You know, I've on previous occasions mentioned the fact that, you know, for countries like Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, coffee cultivation has been a very important source of the agriculture, therefore source of export revenue. Two things happen in the world. The first is that there are countries who previously didn't produce coffee, like Vietnam, will start producing. And suddenly there's more coffee available. And Brazil, I mean, researchers are saying they plant coffee only above the frost line. So the yields are a hell of a lot better.
Shouldn't somebody work their gender?
Yeah. I can also hear in my sleep like that. The coffee price didn't fall because Kenya, Uganda, and Ethiopia were doing the same thing that they've always done. Their earnings from coffee production actually fell. So it's very important to understand the world is changing, and what we're looking for, and the kind of issues we put into the discussion is, how can you ensure that because there's more money available, the outcomes should be better? And those outcomes should be measurable in economic improvement, not just in better public services, but also in the other things that happen. And, you know, without trying to predetermine what should happen in countries, these are the issues on the table, so that we can, in fact, weaken the dependence links, and therefore, together be able to enlarge into SADC and the rest of the African continent. The fiscal transfer issue I explained, and I think we touched on the customs union and SADC.
The formula we're saying, made up of those three components of the customs pool divided. Now, if South Africa is growing at the rate that we are, you know, if you bought for the household last month, Mr. Murray, you know, a double door fridge and, you know, a fancy home theater system with a 100-inch plasma screen and all of these things that MPs have in their homes. You did all of this, there would be... Eh? That is what MPs have. When you've done all of that, we've collected a customs duty on this. Now, to what extent does that need to be shared? For me, it's a difficult issue, and it's not raised from the perspective of trying to deny a developmental perspective. I just don't want us to delude ourselves that the elements in the formula on the customs pool are viable unless we can stress test them. Similarly, the excise pool, and I made this joke about how much alcohol we consume and so on. And the developmental component is fixed at 15% of the excise pool. It's okay. But unless you've got that inverse relationship so that you help the countries that are poorest, there's something wrong. And this is the thinking that we're putting into the discussion. There are all kinds of consultants brought in, some to disprove us and so on and so on. The debate will have to be resolved between ministers. The secretariat is primarily an administrative body. I'm tying up what you're saying with what the new boy, Mr. Singh, but he's an old boy, actually, come back, you know. That's how we're trying to deal with those issues. And let me be clear, you're taking decisions in a multilateral environment. It's not our views that have to dominate. Clearly, I mean, it's discussions. People disagree with us. And sometimes there are four countries disagreeing with one of us, you know. And you can't just drive a bus through it and say, you don't like it, go jump in the lake, you know, we're going to do what we feel that we want to do. Multilateral organizations don't work. On the SADC issues, the one question asked by Mr. Johnson relates to the issues of convergence. Now, this RISDP, and you know, Chair, some of these things are so difficult. I mean, we're skimming over it. But partly because we don't have time. But if you accept that as South Africa, we're going to be part of Southern Africa, and SADC is going to be important, then we must almost spend a day together talking just about the RISDP, with each member having gone through the document, and we try and develop a common perspective on it. So you can then understand what these convergence criteria are. Now, sometimes I hear colleagues say, no, you know, we're going to throw all of those economic policies overboard. That's okay. Somehow, if your prices don't work and if you can't link in, say, here's a computer, I can sit and write a software program that wouldn't be compatible with anything else in the world. My printer wouldn't even read what I'm producing here. It's not going to get me very far down the track. So the issue of convergence criteria, I think, would be straightforward. Part of it is that even those countries that may be in arrears, they have Article 4 reports done. go to the IMF website, look up any country, say Zimbabwe, you are in arrears with the IMF. No, you're not. You paid, but you know, you have no relationship. What are the macroeconomic measurements that the IMF has for Zimbabwe? You're going to find it there. Because the surveillance mandate is not optional. It's a, the Article 4 mandate is a, for surveillance in the IMF is a compulsory thing that must be done. So the world knows. And all that the heads of state did in accepting this indicative strategic program was to say, we accept the convergence criteria. To get there, I mean, we had long, long, long debates as the finance ministers. We were still chairing the sector in SADC. We didn't want to jump straight to a protocol. We built this thing up. And we worked through this in some detail. And I think there was a general acceptance. Probably sometimes governments change. And then people no longer accept it. The questions on the African institutions, the first is, if there's one reality that certainly is very dominant now, and that is that no country can isolate itself from the global economy. It means that you have to fight harder because there are people who move a lot faster. When the mile was first run in sub 4 minutes, it was a big achievement. There are so many other people who've broken past that. What was his name? Ian Banner. Was it?
Roger Bannister.
Thank you, Momo. Thank you. Roger Bannister. It's going to be the same with the economy. You can't just stay in one place. And so every element of what we do, we're going to have to carve out a niche for ourselves. But I think we also need to collaborate with the rest of the countries on the continent. You know, there was a time when, relative to Zimbabwe, I mean, they were actually quite big producers of textile goods. But, you know, the rate of change has just overtaken them, so their factories standing abandoned. And that's, I think, what we have to try and prevent. And you need very tight engagement. Both between governments, but also between business, between trade unions, and amongst all of them, to be able to just remain alive to it. Sometimes there will be big disagreements about these things. The Honorable Singh asks what our shareholding is. Now, the shareholding of the in the ADB is split into two. The one part is the regional shareholders, that would be the 53 African member states. And the other part is the non-regionals. So there are shareholders, like many developed countries. The ratio is 60-40, yes. It was 66. It's 60% African. A large part of your shares are taken up and others are would be callable capital, and we are now the second largest African shareholder at 4.5%, and we'll probably subscribe to another batch of shares that has become available that will take us up to 4.8% share. The questions that Mr. Beatley asked about the middle income countries, it's a point I was trying to raise earlier, that we borrow, and I'm going to tie this up with the Honorable Johnson's question, we borrow, we go to the market, we borrow, sometimes we borrow because we need finance to finance our deficit, sometimes we borrow to refinance previous borrowing. And the last issue would have been a foreign.
Speak. Don't be shy. I've never known you to be shy yet. No, just talk about this issue with Richard.
I thought that I was giving a free ride. The most recent borrowing exercise that we had done was actually a debt consolidation. We had to buy back our short-term debt and rolled that into a new bond that matures in 15 years at a time. It was done as part of a risk mitigation exercise. The global economy is an uncertain one. And the risk that we were exposed to running a current account deficit is that we had a risk of a sudden stop. At the moment, the world has been quite happy to finance the current account deficit. But from a policy perspective, the question that we had to ask ourselves was, what if that stops? And just based from previous experience, if that stops, naturally what happens is that creditors do not roll your short-term debt. In other words, you are unable to refinance the debt that that is maturing. So what we then did was to buy back the short-term debt so that when the ease stops, the risk is not mitigated. We have seen that when the first turmoil hit on the 10th of August, we were affected like everyone else. But market players were able to look at South Africa and say that you have got solid fundamentals, but also that we didn't have debt that was immediately maturing that we could buy back. You couldn't buy back the debt unless you had money in the bank, and we had the money in the bank because we ran a fiscal surplus. Just to conclude, memories they disappear quickly, especially amongst a market player. But for some reason, they seem to be coming in some 10-year, 15-year legs. That every 10 to 15 years or so, market players forget that bull runs do come to an end at some stage and you get hit by a bear market. Now, that seems to be consistent with the entry of other players in the market, that 10 to 15 years is roughly the time when there are young people who would have come and would say, yes, the bear market can happen, but not in our lifetime. Now, I happen to have a bad memory, and I remember that in 1998, I happened to have taken my car in for service, and I had to walk in Pretoria some 8 blocks from Acadia to the minister's office, where he was waiting with the governor of the Reserve Bank then, to tell him that he doesn't have money to meet government obligations over the next 3 or so days, and we had to go and concoct something, find different ways of doing it. Of course, we never announced to the country that there was no money, but we managed to find the money. Now, for those of us who... We happened to remember that. And when you say these stories and you tell the young economists who have just come into the treasury, they say, well, it might have been then, but it won't happen in our lifetime. I am leaving that for the committee, that these things do happen in cycles and they do occur.
I wanted to say to the Honourable Beatrice, you see, we can go to the market and we borrow. And we look at our position and we say, well, let's consolidate the debt, let's borrow. What is the interest that we would pay over the 10 years or 15 years or whatever we negotiate? And at the conclusion of a week's work, we can basically have the money. The World Bank has a kind of 18-month cycle. You know, there's a project analysis, this, that, and the other. And that's longer than even our fiscal year. And secondly, the interest rates are a bit higher than what we borrow. So which is why we say,
as a middle income country, it doesn't always work in our favor, but sometimes we can get technical expertise. And so for some kinds of projects, I mean, you have to take this through. Mr. Singh asks whether the World Bank lends beyond governments, and they do. There's a part of the World Bank called the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, which is the private sector arm. And if you visit their website, you will find, I think they publish all of the investments that they've made in a country like ours. There is an ongoing debate around subnational lending, and some countries actually ask. But there's also concern because, you know, what happened in Brazil about 15 years ago was that states were borrowing directly from the World Bank, and the loans were guaranteed by the federal government. And when the states couldn't repay, all of the debt bounced up and created enormous difficulties for the federal government. So there's a lot of concern about that issue. Which is why you'll find the way in which the borrowing powers of provincial governments. Yes, how that act is structured. Of course you can borrow, but you need the approval of the other 8 provinces. And you know, you need to convince them and the Ministry of Finance and so on and so on. But of course these things are possible. Not so easy. The question by Mr. Johnson, so firstly, I mean, let's separate them out. The Article 4 report, you know, it's the IMF's view, which is why I'm saying we'll release it. But we release it with that caveat, it's the IMF's view. It's the IMF's view, and we reserve the right to disagree with the IMF on their view, their surveillance views on our economy. That's fine. And I think they accept that as well. And I have never believed that the IMF is God and that the IMF's word is infallible. I don't believe that. So if they say something, I mean, accept it in that way. It helps to have a number of different voices supporting the policy decisions that we've taken. But you know, don't ever accept the word of any economist or group of economists as being infallible. I think if you do that, you're going to run yourself into trouble very soon. The situation in respect of our fiscal stance. I don't believe that the Minister of Finance can get up and speak about his or her views. A budget won't work unless it is the budget of the executive. All of the executive needs to be involved, needs to take collective ownership. From time to time, I mean, you watch the debates, the policy debates, and you know there are some seasoned campaigners in various committees who always say the money we have is not enough. But as a rule, ministers accept that is their allocation, that is what they have to live with, and that is what creates the basis for accountability between the administration and parliament. The accounting officers are therefore important. If they don't accept that, if the DG here says, look, they gave me 10 rand, but I know I should be getting 20 rand, and decides to spend the 20 rand nonetheless, he will end up with a disclaimer as an audit opinion, and he will be in big trouble when he comes to school. You can only get there if you have collective appreciation. So the fiscal stance is collectively appreciated. You know, I don't think... I think that the researcher has spelled this thing out in some detail. It's not as though what you don't spend you can do something else with. I mean, debt service costs is a very worrying thing.
Let me say for the benefit of Mr. Johnson, Karl Marx wrote about capital. And in writing about capital, he said that what public debt does is it turns debt capital, which is lazy, into something that earns wealth for the owner. It doesn't even have to bother to create employment. It's just there because governments want to borrow all this money. Now, I don't know. Somehow the left now thinks that Karl Marx didn't write those things. Or they thought perhaps he wrote Das Arbeit and not Das Kapital. But it's there. It's been there for a long time in the discourse around public finance. We've been able to demonstrate, and there's a graph in the budget review that shows as that debt service costs decrease, we have more money to spend on public services. And I think that that is a very significant achievement. It allows us to then take policy decisions about what we want to spend. You see, when we tabled the surplus, there was debate in some quarters about how crazy this is and so on and so on. And amongst the issues that we said is, these markets are not constant. Lucetia says every 10 years or so. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary in the United States, wrote a piece earlier that was published earlier this week that said, financial crises have come in 3-year cycles. Part of what has been driving our growth has been consumer spending in a low interest environment and very strong commodity prices. And we said, somehow we need to just be careful. Let's not spend what we haven't earned yet. And that's the posture. I mean, I can say to you that there was a huge debate within the executives. But when we accepted, we accepted. Last year's, of course, was an underspending issue. And the overcollection on the revenue side, this one is more planned, but it's there. But I can't ever claim sole responsibility because these decisions have to be collected. I don't know, I can't answer the question how we can best ensure that Parliament is able to leverage off the opportunity. I mean, there's one job I don't think I would want to have. And that is to be a member of Parliament, to have to deal with all of these issues without the support that I come here with. I don't know how people do it. I don't know how people do it. But the unique position, I mean, we expect that Parliament is only a place for people who are available for membership of Mensa, can manage all of this information, take decisions 7 days a week, sit with piles of documents, read outside of those documents, understand the world. I think it's a very fair, unfair advantage, Chair. So really, you know, I'm not raising it to run away from, but I'm saying we're open, you know. I mean, take the experiences here, and I think it was a good experience, because we had the president of the World Bank and a few of the other, the president of the African Development Bank, part of the leadership of the IMF, here in Parliament, on the parliamentary forum on the World Bank, the network. It was a good meeting. But is that meeting sufficient to leverage office?
Thank you, Chair.
I still have three hands. Mr.
Chair. Ms. Fubs is going to thank...
Can't we just conclude the three remaining hands?
Okay, but... Yeah. Okay, then I'm going to... Okay.
The response could be taken with the three, so in the interest of time.
Thank you, Chair. I'll ask only three short ones. Only leadership of IMF. South Africa has begged Dominic Kantorkan. Thou Russia objected that he does not have a technical physical know-how of technical skills. Why does South Africa beg him? Second question here. On the issue of the welfare, the DJ has already answered part of the question. But my question is, we borrowed from the World Bank for technical assistance, I think it was 2 years or 3 years ago, $1 million or 1 million, right? But how much we borrowed this time, and what does the IMF say about the vulnerability of South Africa due to the current, the current state, as my GDP is vulnerable to, as DJ said, the stop of inflows, the high give for the wide interest rate, or it also has an outside shock, and the commodity prices are in default. You are vulnerable to that. The last one here is just on the... Oh, so we thought that the donations previous in the years used to come to South Africa from all over the world for a specific whatever purpose. How much do we get now donations in Africa, and how much does it come to... How much does it come to South Africa? Thanks.
For the interest of time, Chairperson, I won't ask questions. But nonetheless, I will want to say that, Chairperson, that I think we have to have an official ruling as this committee as to how often do we meet, so that we cannot have this rush and begin to have a pile of information, and within as the minister has now said now, within a short space of time, we have to ask questions and to understand how does the world perform so on. But I think we as this committee, at least coming up with a proposal, Chairperson, at least we should meet once in 6 months after the year. And yeah, so that we can be able to engage each other. That in very progressive now, Chairperson, all that question.
And I will invite you to the management meeting when we plan the next term's, when we look at the next term's program. Mr. Mlot.
Chair, I disagree with you.
Thank you. Let me quickly join the other Imbongis in congratulating the minister for the presentation. My quick question is, I think I read in one of the daily newspapers that National Treasury had a meeting with hedge funds, I think it's this week or last week, I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it's hedge funds, private equity dealers, or whatever, I'm not sure. But there was this view that the British ones are opting for more regulation and South Africa wants more of engagement. Why do you adopt that approach?
Okay, starting with Ms. Fox's question.
Chair, I mean, in the construct of the agreement at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944, the bank was styled as a bank, and the bank needs shareholders. And the IMF was styled as a credit union. And the right to draw is in some proportion to the size of the shareholder. And there is some quasi-mathematical formula that's used to determine shareholding in relation to share of world output. Now, When these institutions were started, there was every country was entitled to a basic vote, and then on top of that, the shareholding. But the basic vote, as a share of the total, has diminished. And there are proposals now to actually increase the basic vote. But you know, these are hard contested issues. The second issue is, as with any mathematical ratio of shareholding, you must add back to 100%. So you need to do this in a way, because nobody wants to give up. Everybody wants more, nobody wants to give up. The U.S., I mean, at the time, the compromise that Keynes had struck was to allow A, the institutions to be based in the United States, and B, the decision-making structures were so arranged that on a number of these issues you need an 85% vote, and the U.S. has about 18%. So they have an effective veto. It's rather unfortunate. But you know, if you look at the African Development Bank, and seeing it less, but if you look at the African Development Bank, it's also a shareholding structure. Now, it used to be two-thirds and one-third, two-thirds African, one-third non-regional. But African countries would get up and pledge. But you don't need a pledge, you need money. You need money on the table, you need to take up your shares, and that costs money because, you know, banks are banks. And if you can't pay for your shares, then you can't take them up. And so unfair as it is, you know, the debate right now is whether you can increase the basic vote, whether there's some other measure other than market rate so that you have more purchasing power parity as a basis. The PPP calculations for the world will be released, I think, in December this year. And there's some debate now on whether for the quotas you can look at 50% market, 50% PPP, some new blend is being sought. These are debates that carry on for a very long period because there's always very extensive resistance. Interestingly now, because the key element in the formula for quotas is share of total output, the U.S. has offered, and they can be generous, that they will not seek to take up any more shares. So even though their share of total world output may be closer to the 23% mark, they'll allow for that 5% between where they are and that level to be apportioned to the developing world. They can afford to be generous. You've got a visa in your pocket. You can afford to be generous. But other regions aren't as generous. The U.S., for instance, argues that Europe has 10 different seats, I mean, if you include Switzerland and so on. But about 6 of them are in the Eurozone where they have a common monetary area. But these debates, nobody gives up what they have. On Dominic Strauss-Kahn, we said, I mean, I don't know, perhaps there's a generous interpretation in the press, because we've said to Mr. Strauss-Kahn and to everybody who cares to listen that we want an open process. I say that the Russians have advanced the name. It's the only other name, and it's a complex issue because you would have seen that the Czech Republic, the country where Tosovsky was the governor, is not backing him. But Russia is. Now, it's an interesting debate. Now, Tosovsky was the central bank governor for a very long period of time. Dominic Strauss-Kahn was a finance minister. I don't know how the Russian ED says that he's not competent. He's got a doctorate in economics. and he's got a degree in public law. And he was a finance minister in France. He's an intellectual in own name, right, published quite extensively. I don't know how they say that he's not competent, but... and he's a strong social democrat. He's one of the strongest left-of-center thinkers in Europe, actually, amongst those who've published. But, you know, I don't know. The second question lost me a bit, because the World Bank, we haven't borrowed now. I mean, you kind of borrow to keep the door open. You know, when I was growing up, we used to buy on the book, and the shopkeeper had a cigarette box, and he used to write these things on there, you know. And sometimes, just to keep your book open, you know, you buy something small. It's the same thing. This was actually in respect of local government. They keep the book open. But of course, the current account deficit is a vulnerability. But you know, I think it's something that we measure and monitor. I mean, when the IMF says it in the Article 44, not a surprise to us. We have a reasonable measure, and but the one thing we have said is that given the scale of the global imbalances, there isn't an adequate measure, because the flows are quite different from the bulk of textbooks that were written for sort of sovereign cells. I mean, there's far more global integration in the economy now.
Do we have a number for ODA?
Speak there, please, because you can...
Thank you, Chair. And if I understand the question correctly, then the question of ODA into South Africa and ODA out of South Africa. Now, ODA into South Africa, one has to get a figure based on a definition that could have been a definition designed by an organization like the OECD. So we may be comparing apples with oranges. But on the definition of ODA, it is about 1 billion. It represents almost under 1% of total budget, and over time that number, that percentage is decreasing. Now, increasingly, and the presentation said that we are developing a policy on the development assistance that Africa is providing into Africa. And one of the first things that we need to do is to get to a definition. So sort out the objectives, but to get to a definition on what do we understand by overseas development assistance. Take for instance the development component that the minister spoke about in the cycle revenue sharing formula. Question we need to ask ourselves, do we count that as ODA? The support we're giving to the DRC. There are some warm bodies there, but it's also cash that we provided to support the election and some other post-conflict support. So those they are amounts that gets attached to the support that we're providing. And until such time that we, you know, that we sort out the definition and we look at the OECD definition, etc., I think then only can we put a figure to the ODA that is being provided by South Africa. I mean, the clear numbers is the one that we allocate to the African Renaissance Fund, and it's an amount that Parliament appropriates. In the last budget, we replenished the ARF by about 150 million. So if I you know, should take a risk here and start adding things up without, as I said, a clear definition so that I can, you know, compare apples with apples. I would say about 250 million. That includes A or F and some other things. Thank you.
I don't know what the meeting is that Mr. Muloto knows about. DG doesn't know. And the deputy DG there doesn't know. Freya, do you know? Sumisa? Ghost? Very much? We plead not guilty. But, you know, the issue of hedge funds and private equity funds is one that we've been watching over a very long period. There are different approaches to this in the world. There's one view that says, don't worry about the hedge funds. It's just bubbles on a steady stream. Worry about the stream, not the bubbles, in other words. There's one view that says, well, you know, if the banks comply with Basel, and they have used some of their money into the hedge fund, they've got capital against that. The bank is regulated, you don't need to regulate the hedge fund. I think what the current milieu has shown is that some of the norms that we look for are not in place. And one of the first things would be that the derivative instruments are not regulated, and what you've got, and you know, we can show this thing. I've spoken about the numbers just now on the JSE top 40 in a single day. But you can trace that back. You can trace it back to the subprime lending. And more than the subprime lending, it was the way in which they wrapped this up and sold it as triple A rated stuff. And the rating agencies were happy to do with that. So the check and balance in the system, namely the rating agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, etc., had failed the system. Walala wasal. It works even there. And so their snoozing has cost a lot of pensioners their earnings. When it's operating like that, it's not just a bubble on a steady stream, there's something else happening. And I think with private equity, you know, the jury's still out, but One of the views in the church, and there's no, frequently it takes a long time to get a single view, but one of the views in the treasury is that what has happened with a lot of private equity is there'd be a deal between management and the private equity fund, and they buy the company at a discounted rate. Now, One large American rubber chemical company, I think it was Dresser Wayne, actually fired the top, the CEO, the CFO, and so on, because they were doing a deal with the private equity fund as though they owned the company. They were just employees of the company. So they sell at a discount, the shareholders lose it, frequently the shareholders, the institutions, pension funds. And then they spend time and look at this, and everybody believes that these whiz kids go in. They're deal makers, but they go in and they now pretend that they know everything about management. They spend a few months on this and say, now we've retooled this company. Frequently they just fire a few people and so on. We've retooled this company, it is strong, powerful, and so on. We will list it now at a premium. And when you see, any retirement fund would need a balanced portfolio. So if on the industrial board you've lost that, you try and get it back, you sold the discount, you buy at a premium now, that difference is carried by pension fund contributors. So I don't know where the glory of this is. It's not a... I mean, there's a way in which there's a kind of zero sum. gain, because there's no immediate value addition. But the losses tend to be for those other than those who manage a private equity firm.
So, but I'm saying it's just one view, it's not a treasury view. It's just one view.
I'm familiar with people who think like that, but I can't admit to who they are. But you know, the key question is whether at least for a while, this generation will learn from this, or whether there is again what Alan Greenspan called irrational exuberance. Because you need an index of irrational exuberance, the IIE, to know just how far people are going wonky because they think mathematics replaces all else. Thank you, Chair.
So thanks for this, Daniel. Tim, this really has been a useful exercise, being the first, and I can see that you've whetted our appetites such that we're actually beginning to think whether we shouldn't be doing this more often. But we will finalize that in the ensuing discussions. Once again, thank you very much. This was very useful. Members with...
Sorry to interrupt you. I'm doing a very, very bad thing. I want to go back to the question that John Hobbs had asked. There's a very interesting book, and the book is available. You can download the entire book from the internet. It's called A Better Globalization by Kemal Dervish. Dervish. D-E-R-V-I-S. And the S has a little thing at the bottom. He's now the head of the A Better Globalization by Kemal, K-E-M-A-L, Dervis, D-E-R-V-I-S. The book is published by the Brookings Institute, but it's available. You can download it. It actually constructs an interesting proposal for an economic security council that should have more dominance in world economic affairs, and it's by region, population, military strength. It's an interesting approach buried in that book. I highly commend it to my colleagues in politics. Thank you, Chair. Sorry.
Bearing in mind that you continue to overburden the under-resourced. Thank you very much, members. Unfortunately, we have run into your lunch hour. Please be economical in eating also. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.